Dean Norhall, please be seated.
Good morning.
Morning.
Anything arising from Wednesday?
Nothing okay. For me, thank you.
Very good. So, we'll stick from your submissions.
Good morning.
Your Honour.
I can be quite brief in responding to Dr. Somerville's reply to the submissions of legal counsel. And with the exception of one point, I won't repeat what other counsel have already addressed you on. And the one point that I do want to come back to is his paragraph 6. So that's the first matter on which I want to speak briefly. The position that Dr. Somerville has taken is that Section 124 applies in the situation we find ourselves in, but only up to the 1st of October 2021, which is the point at which the deemed permits expire. In my submission, that can't be the position because there is no need for Section 124 before the 1st of October 2021. And the reason for that is that up until the 1st of October 2021, these deemed permits are exactly that. They are deemed permits which are resource consents in their own right. And Ms. Williams took you earlier in the week, and I would do the same, to the various sections of the Act that get us to that point. And I've addressed them in paragraph 15 of my submissions of the 15th of June, where I have pointed out that section 87D of the Act defines a water permit as a consent, and section 4131C determines that a mining privilege is a water permit. So you put those two together, and the mining permits were given life as water permits, as resource consents, post the coming into the Act and up until the 1st of October of this year. So the real issue is not the status of Section 124 in relation to these matters prior to the 1st of October this year, but post this year. And that, of course, is the point at which the Council in the room and Dr. Somerville part company. My second point relates to the cases that I have discussed in my submissions of the 15th of June. And I've taken the court in those submissions to two practical examples that I'm familiar with, where the question of Section 124 post the expiry of what were deemed permits was in play. And the two cases concerned the consenting of the Clutha scheme and the consenting of the Wairaki geothermal scheme, both of which had a sunset clause in very similar terms to those applying to the mining rights, and both of which were given a life under the Act of 10 years, so a considerably shorter period of time. But their final expiry, and the language is exactly the same, was 1 October 2001. So in terms of those cases, Dr. Somerville has suggested at his paragraphs 16 and 17 that essentially the regional councils had acquiesced in the deemed permit continuing to be operated as if it were lawful, notwithstanding that it had finally expired on the 1st of October 2001. And with the greatest respect to Dr. Somerville, we don't know that the council simply acquiesced in that situation. We don't know whether the councils themselves took legal advice, considered the situation, came to the conclusion that the situation was as council in this room have suggested that it is. I accept that there is little discussion in the Environment Court decisions on the point, but in itself, little discussion of something does not provide evidence that a position is wrong. There are many sections in the Act that have not been discussed in court decisions, I imagine, despite 30 years of litigation now of the RMA. Some things can be so self-evidently right that they don't need to be discussed by the court. But even if we set that aside, in fact, the court did turn its mind to this.
Are you saying it should be so self-evidently obvious to this court, and me in particular, that you are right and that the question should not have been raised?
I wouldn't suggest that, Your Honour. No, I wouldn't go that far.
So then what was that?
But I am saying that certainly for courts in the past, that may have been...
May have been the case, maybe that it wasn't raised and the court just simply didn't turn their mind to it.
Well, my point, Your Honour, is that at least in one situation we know the court did turn its mind to it, and that's the Rotokawa decision, which I've quoted at paragraph 27 of my submissions of the 15th of June.
Have you provided those cases for the court?
I haven't. I'm not sure whether Mr. Welsh did. Mr. Welsh says he has a copy, Your Honour, because I know that he did as well. I haven't been back to my office since receiving Dr. Somerville's material a couple of days ago, so it's been a little bit hard to access any additional material. But I can certainly provide that case. Mr. Welsh says he has it anyway.
Well, that would be handy to actually have the case in front of me, wouldn't it?
It would. It would be useful to the court, I think, to understand the context. Though Dr. Somerville is quite right, this is the only reference. There is not discussion of the point, which comes back to my earlier point that it may be that the court considered that there didn't need to be discussion because it could see the position.
You're speculating, are you not?
I'm sorry?
You're speculating.
I am,
yes.
But in exactly the same way as I think Dr. Somerville was speculating.
Well, you're both speculating.
Yes, to that extent. Except that my point is that the court did turn its mind to it. There is a reference. It's obiter, because the question was not squarely before the court, because there had not been discussion on it. But the court obviously, in my submission, turned its mind to it. Otherwise, it would not have made the reference that it makes, that Section 124 rights enabled the continued exercise of the consents. So whether there was discussion or not before the court, it was obviously satisfied that that was the situation and recorded that in its judgment. So in my submission, Your Honour, there is a relevant finding of the court. There are relevant precedents in practice. Perhaps that's simply context, but it is useful to understand how this issue has been approached. This is not a new issue. The situation has been around for us in relation to other deemed permits for quite some time. And there is, in my submission, no precedent that says that Section 124 does not apply to deemed permits post their expiry date. The third point relates really to teasing this out a little bit more in terms of understanding Parliament's intent. In light of Dr. Somerville's statement at paragraph 29 of his submissions, written reply, with which I'm sure we would all agree, there is an interpretive presumption that Parliament intends to legislate in a way that produces a practicable, workable and sensible result. Now, coming back to the analysis in my submissions of the drafting, the language of sections 386 and 387, which are the sections that created and applied the deemed permit regime for the two cases that I've discussed, Clutha and Wairaki. As I've noted, the language is similar, the same. The only differences are contextual differences. They all refer to final expiry. They finally expire at a certain date. As I've addressed in my submissions, they have a duration is put in by way of the Act, and so on. I probably don't need to take you through that again. I presume that Dr. Somerville accepts that analysis because he doesn't take issue with it. So the similarities of language, I think, stand between Section 413 and Section 386 and Section 387. So, accepting that the language applies and that the situation was intended by Parliament to be the same across the raft of deemed permits that Parliament was addressing, a variety of situations, essentially providing for a way forward for schemes, projects, sets of permissions, authorities, the language is variable, that had been authorised by other legislation prior to the coming into force of the RMA. So the Clutha scheme obviously hinges on the Clyde Dam Empowering Act. Wairaki essentially was the Geothermal Energy Act of 1953, and so on. So Parliament was turning its mind to how to provide for those post the coming into force of the RMA, and intended in my submission to give them a reasonable life. So created the deemed permits for them, they acted as resource consents, but gave them a reasonable life to function in that way before going through the consenting process that turned them into the RMA consents that we have today. Now, the period that was chosen for the two schemes was 10 years. If we take the position that Dr. Somerville has proposed, and knowing that it took 6.5 years in each case for those projects to be consented under the RMA, the consents didn't come out of the appeal process for either until 2007. In the case of the Clutha scheme, there was an appeal to the High Court that extended the period and so on. So we're looking about 6.5 years. On Dr. Somerville's analysis, the company needing to replace those deemed permits with resource consents should have known to apply for those resource consents at the latest, somewhere in 1994, because it should have known that it could not rely on being able to continue to operate post 1 October 2001. Now, in 1994, the Act was in its infancy. There were barely any regional plans or district plans. They too were in their infancy. Councils were coming to grips with how to write these documents, and we all know how long the first generation plans took. In my submission, that cannot have been Parliament's intention. It did not intend to give these projects, in effect, about 2.5 years of real life. It intended to give them 10.
So here is your submission addressing the final expiry of the deemed permits under Section 386, and I think you said Section 387, as at a date 10 years after the Commencement Act, the commencement of the Act, or is your submission addressing rights, any rights which are attached to those permits as deemed conditions, or both?
I wouldn't have framed it quite like that, but I suppose it's a mixture of both. I'm trying to understand, given and applying an interpretive approach that says Parliament means something to be workable, sensible, practicable, etc. What I'm working to, Your Honour, is a position that Parliament would have intended to provide some certainty and demonstrating that if Dr. Somerville's position is right, there is no certainty. Parliament intended, in my submission, to give these consents 10 years of life, but also a reasonable period to apply for, to work through the process of applying for new consents under the Act. And of course, Section 124 provides exactly that, because it says you must apply 6 months before, or 3 months with Council's discretion, but certainly by 1 April, in the case of the two projects I'm talking about, 2001. And that's how Parliament provided the certainty, and then you apply the rest of Section 124, which allows a former consent to continue to be relied upon post the expiry date under Section 124. Now, Parliament intended these consents to be replaced. Parliament intended, gave a time frame. Parliament gave the certainty of a definite date for when they must be applied for. But then in my submission also recognised that the one thing the applicant absolutely does not control in this situation is processing time. I don't imagine anybody expected that it would take 6.5 years to consent Wairaki or the Clutha scheme, which is why my suggestion that somehow the applicant should have known this and known to you know, apply back in 1994 or something. In my submission, the Act can't have been intended to work in that way. But the thing that the applicant cannot control is processing time, and therefore Section 124, in fairness and making the Act practicable and workable, etc., provides that protection of allowing the applicant who's replacing their consents to continue to operate under the former consents, while Council and, if necessary, the courts deal with the processing and any appeals that might arise. And in my submission, that's an interpretation which is consistent with a practicable, workable, sensible framework. It avoids the messiness of the applicant somehow having to guess how long the processing and any appeals might take. And it's fair, because the applicant has no control over those timeframes. And it's certain, because the Act provides for the situation through the six-month requirement.
So, what do you think in relation to section 386, subsection 8, is getting at? So, section 386 is dealing with existing rights and authorities under the Water and Soil Conservation Act. Subsection 8 says nothing in this section applies in respect of any mining privilege under mining privilege within the meaning of section 4131. Why would Parliament need to, if it was providing comprehensively for permits, I think you're saying is in relation to one of the big dams, either Clutha or what was the other dam? Yeah, section 386 provides for what? Was then utilised by what? Clutha and Wairaki?
Wairaki.
Yes. Why the carve-out from mining privileges under that section, such that they're dealt with separately under section 413? So, and I'll confess that I have not read 386 in detail, or line by line.
My friends may have other thoughts, but I had taken that to mean that the sections in 386 apply to water takes, so cover, for example, 386 was the section that was used to deal with the water permits for the ongoing operation, for example, of Wairaki. I had assumed that what Parliament was intending was to make it clear that the mining privileges have their own section, and that this section was not intended to apply. This 1-7 was not intended to apply to the mining privileges.
So, of the cases that you have referred, but I don't believe we've got a copy yet in court, which case deals with Wairaki and which deals with Clutha?
The references were actually given in Dr. Somerville's footnotes. I'm not familiar with Ryder and Manawatu Wanganui Regional Council, which he refers
to. I'm sorry.
One of the cases he refers to is Ryder, which is not the case that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Rotokawa Joint Venture and Waikato Regional Council, his footnote 7, is the Wairaki scheme. Rotokawa Joint Venture Limited was simply the first appellant named, and that's why they appear first on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Recontact Energy Limited is the Clutha scheme. I'll get those cases for your honour.
I would be grateful. And do either of those schemes deal with deemed permits or not? That is, mining privileges, which are deemed to be water permits under section 413, or are they solely concerned with section 386?
My understanding is that they are, it's wee while since I've really read them from beginning to end, they are 386 cases. I think there may be some discussion of mining privileges in them as incidental to, because of course you talk about water in Otago. In any context, really, you end up referring to the mining privileges, which are such a feature of this region.
And in fact, I'm going to talk to you in a moment or two in the context of the Vares question you've raised about the point almost where Clutha and mining privileges kind of coincide.
Clutha and mining privileges.
Pardon?
So at the point at which?
There is, my point is that it's hard to talk about water in the context of Otago at all without somehow or other the mining privileges coming into the picture. And I can give you an example of that in a moment. But in the context of consenting the Clutha scheme, no.
Okay.
From memory.
And is there any case law dealing with Section 387? Or is that Ryder?
Wairaki deals in part with 387. The consents that were reissued issued for Wairaki are a mixture because of the way geothermal water is defined and because of the way water is defined in the Act and really the history of Wairaki in the 60s. It's a mixture of water takes and permits and a licensing scheme. Those are the points I wanted to make, Your Honour, in relation to the priority position directly. You did ask a subsequent question in relation to the vares of the proposed priority condition. And my friend Mr. Moore has addressed you on this on Tuesday. And I'm very happy to adopt his submissions, and there's no need for me to repeat the points that he has made. But I did think there was one useful example I could give you of a condition that I'm familiar with that, and it again arises out of the Clutha, that addresses, I think, the concern that you have as to the creation of a regime that appears to allocate water as between parties. Now, one of the points I think that Mr. Moore made a couple of days ago was that, in fact, the allocation of water and allocating and regulating access to water as between water users is a function of a regional council. And that does mean allocating between parties in some instances. And while we have been focused a lot in this hearing on priorities to protect galaxids and thinking about the need for priority for environmental reasons, the need to maintain the effect of the priorities in relation to this question of allocation between parties, I think, is a live and valid issue before the court as well. And that's, in my submission, the discussion of the last couple of days has been around that as well as the galaxids. So the condition that I was thinking about that has been used by Otago Regional Council and has been imposed for some time arises out of the fact that as pressure has gone on the Clutha as a source of water for irrigation, for all sorts of uses, but principally for irrigation, particularly as the need to protect the tributaries and the smaller water bodies around the region has become apparent. The Clutha, of course, at first blush, is an abundant source of water. It's also a key factor in something like 750 megawatts of renewable generation in this country. So it's not entirely an abundant source of water. There are times of the year when water in the Clutha is more valuable to electricity generation than at others. So a condition has been developed that in one sense protects contacts access to water, while at the same time giving access to the same water to applicants who are seeking it, but which also protects the environment. What I'm thinking about, the circumstances of the background are that Clutha is a run-of-river scheme. The only storage on the scheme is 9 hours in water travel time above the Clyde Dam. The operating range of Lake Dunstan, for good environmental reasons, is only a metre. And while there's a broader operating range in Lake Hawea, which is the storage to the north, it's not extensive either. So there is a set of circumstances where, in order to ensure that the operating range of Lake Dunstan can be maintained, and in order to ensure that Lake Hawea doesn't drop below the minimum level set, again, for good environmental reasons, and in combination with the fact that the scheme is very dependent on inflows into Lake Dunstan between Lake Hawea and the Clyde Dam, and during the winter, this is the reverse of the North Island, incidentally, during the winter, those inflows drop because, literally, the water is tied up in snow. It's the snow melt in the spring that brings the water into the river. So there is a set of circumstances where, in order to ensure that the environmental circumstances can be addressed, a condition is imposed on applicants for water to take from the Clutha that requires them to stop taking at certain times. And the condition was actually put in place in a decision that is actually before this court on appeal, but this is not the matter that's on appeal. It's the Queensbury Ridges case, which is one of the cases that's been put on hold until PC7 is determined.
So so the condition has been imposed on Queensbury?
The condition has been imposed on Queensbury, and this is not what's been appealed. It's the appeal is about duration, as you might expect. Mm. But basically the way that the condition works, the set of circumstances that I'm referring to, no take from the Clutha Mata'o between the 1st of May and the 31st of August, so that deals with the winter low flows issue, and also, of course, is the non-irrigation season. So no take from the Clutha between the 1st of May and the 31st of August, and then a requirement to cease abstraction when specified river flows and a Lake Hawea level, the combination, are triggered. Now, I'm happy to provide this to you in writing, Your Honour. But basically what the condition does is to, apart from that time period, to take a measurement of the combined flows in the Clutha Mata'o at Cadrona, Kawaro River, Chards Road, Nevis River at Wentworth, and the Manahirakira River at Ophir, when they combined are below 250 cubics per hour, then flows also have to, then takes also have to cease. So in my submission, there is recognising the need to protect another party's access to water is
established already in this region. And that's an example of how
I don't think that I have ever indicated, at least for my part, that I have a difficulty in principle with doing something in this space. If I had thought that I had a difficulty in principle, I would have taken a different course. The problem for the court has always been that the relief proposed, either in the submissions or by witnesses, is ineffective. Therefore, something else is required, either, as we've seen, the planners proposing their own amendment to a policy and conditions, which is likely, in my view, to be ineffective, or the court endeavouring to come up with its own solution. But frankly, the solution should have been provided by council and parties, I think, at this stage. So it's in principle, yes, we need to be doing something in this space. Central government hasn't, and we need to be therefore looking to do something in this space.
Yes.
Question is, what? We're at the tail end of the hearing and we're still struggling for the solutions to the problem. So in principle, I have no problem with this, and indeed think in terms of managing the effects of abstraction as between users, this is something which is an RMA issue and can properly be dealt with under the RMA. Now, I've never said anything, at least I don't think I've said anything to the contrary. Consequently, have had to expend a lot of resources, your resources as well as the court's resources, trying to look for solutions.
We may have been under the impression that you were concerned about effectively one party asking another to turn off, which is the way the priority condition is framed, and the way the contact condition, for example, is set up.
No. And I haven't, for my part, do not believe that I have ever expressed a concern in principle by one asking another to turn off. But whatever mechanism is proposed, it has to be effective and efficient. It can't be the stalking horse for future litigation. And there, I think, certainly the solutions proposed by the planning witnesses are a stalking horse for future litigation. And it may well be that the court's own solution is a stalking horse for future litigation. It just depends on the records held either by the regional council or by farmers in terms of making the solution work. Where we have also encountered a difficulty is that the court, perhaps with the exception of Ms. Williams' submissions, has not been provided good submissions or submissions on statutory interpretation so as to understand what are the priority issues and then understand what the problem is that the court needs to be working on. I can think of one party who's just simply submitted that they couldn't, they didn't see any reason in principle why the court couldn't bring down priorities from the statute. I don't think that's correct, but I do think that it is that there is a real issue that needs to be addressed. And I don't believe that I have said anything different. But actually understanding both the legislative context, what is or is not happening, and then getting ourselves in a position where we go, yes, there is a potential problem that needs to be managed and can be managed properly as an RM solution. That's always been the court's concern.
Right. I understood from the discussion with the panel on Tuesday that there was a level of acceptance across the planning witnesses, and I thought from the court that there was a case for ensuring that the effect, however it's expressed, the effect of the priorities is preserved, for the reasons that my friend on my left, in particular, has explored with your court, but also around this question of providing for adequate water in terms of council's function, providing access to water to a number of users.
I don't have any difficulty with that.
Right.
It's how you get there.
Right. So
I think where the court has not been well assisted by parties who are interested in this is to understand the legislative context which originally created the rights of priorities, and therefore whether these are expiring or not, and if they are expiring, how then this translates into an appropriate RM response. Now, we haven't been well assisted in that, which is why we are either in a factual basis, because there has been virtually no facts, if any facts, produced by the parties to actually then understand, well, okay, so there's these rights of priorities which exist now, how are they being exercised? Then to understand what is the risk if they expire, whether they expire on the 1 October or, best case scenario, they expire at the reconsenting step sometime after 1 October. Mm. If they expire, then what is the risk if there is nothing in this plan change? And that risk, and I have talked on several occasions now about risk, that risk is different depending on which catchment you're in. We've heard from some folk, they do actually exercise the rights of priority pretty much as we understand them to be, which is telling their neighbour to cease or to start reducing water. Other folk don't exercise them because, as in the case of Loban, there's always flow in the Loban. Now, they might be taking it down to low or but no flow, but that's their right in law, and that's how they're exercising them, so they haven't needed to ring up a neighbour and tell them to do anything. Or in the case of Marahedikia, we're told that those rights have been used as leverage or as the platform then to enter into informal and formal agreements which capture all of the tributaries and the main stem of the Marahedikia catchment. So the risk in their case, I would have thought, low going forward, if there was nothing in this plan change. But that's not the case for other people. And so we've tried really hard to try and find the have a proper factual understanding of how these rights are being exercised, therefore to look to have an understanding as to what solutions may be required in the plan change. But in principle, yes, there are people exercising them, and yes, it provides some the initiative or impetus to enter into flow sharing agreements, which if that disappears on 1 October or it disappears, at the time of reconsenting, yes, is problematic. And that is because land use systems have been developed on an understanding that the, we'll talk about farmers in this case, farmers may tell another to turn off and continue to to reduce, and that those land use systems can as best as they're able to in a water short region or a dry region continue to farm. So we've always understood that. What we've not understood and not been in a place well to understand is, as I said, is both the facts and also the legal effect of that instrument, whether the instrument ceases on the 1 October or whether it ceases at some time in the future. So you don't need to convince us about the need for something in this plan change. We've been there and have been there for some time. If we weren't there, we would not be expending the court's resources.
I absolutely agree, Your Honour, and I think everybody accepts that. It may be that the question about the virus that came out at the weekend...
It's the question of... thrown you? Well, it should have.
Well, not thrown us, but no, but made us think that you were continuing to be concerned that
well,
a mechanism...
I think that is because if, and to be blunt, it's actually ORUG which is creating the difficulties. If there is, as ORUG submits, these provisions about deemed permits are not transitional but savings provisions, which can simply be carried down by citing, which is as we understand the submission, citing priorities. In other words, that the
instrument under statute can be replicated and its effect can be replicated in this plan change, then I think we would have a problem with that.
Right.
So it's putting the court... some parties have not placed the court in a good position, factually or in law, to make decisions. As I understand it, it's been the thinking of some witnesses that it is perfectly valid to tell another party to have a condition that can require a third party to turn off. That's the vires issue that I'm concerned about, and that was footnoted in one of the minutes.
So
we're trying to, if you like, avoid that vires issues, and one of the ways to avoid the issue is by neighbours' approvals, or a clearer way, I hoped, was through the policy suggested by the court, which says that the applicant themselves are placing themselves in a position where they will turn off if a neighbour tells them to.
So your concern is the telling to turn off.
It's the idea that it's the idea that I can tell you to turn, I can tell the world to turn off, as opposed to the obligation to turn off if another has required it. So it's
very different from the contact situation where, in fact,
well,
contact is not actually ringing up and saying turn off, but what has been put.
Queensbury
in place,
agreed to that condition, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Yeah, that's right. And so that in that sense. What we have proposed as a court is, and I haven't read the Queensbury conditions, but it sounds like it is like the effect of the Queensbury conditions. But what we understood Ms. O'Rourke's planner and Ms. Perkins to be saying was not like that. But then again, they didn't particularly work through how their regime would work so that the court could have confidence that it wasn't simply a regime which would offend the general principles that you can't have a condition that ostensibly controls a third party. So it was getting back to basics.
I agree. And it may be that this discussion has actually been overtaken by the panel on... And the proposal that Your Honour has put forward, which the planners are now considering, and I know
yeah.
I'm going to, because a lot of what we're talking about really is kind of the virus of the mechanism, as much as the underlying principle, which is perhaps where I was addressing it.
It's the virus in the mechanism, and again, that was clearly signalled in the minute. But the underlying principle, we have been there for some time, hence
right.
the court's real interest to establish the factual basis for those for the exercise so that we could understand what the ambit of the problem was so that whatever response came down in a plan change, it was actually dealing with that problem and was sufficient to deal with the problem
difference in the mechanism that's being proposed is that one neighbour tells another. The main difference in the mechanism is that rather than council directing that a consent holder turn off,
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, but that needed careful thought as to how that would be expressed, both in terms of the plan change and then understanding how that would be picked up in a condition. Now, we hadn't had that thinking in the evidence to date. And indeed, I didn't think that ORC coming into the case was at all supportive of that, because it felt, and again we've heard some evidence from Mr Cummings and Ms King, that, well, if there's a trace in the water record, then that is sufficient. Well, in my view, it's not sufficient because it's not sufficient, and I've indicated that. So maybe that we are in agreement that there needs to be a mechanism in the plan change, and that that needs to be appropriately formulated such that it doesn't infringe a vires issue. It is intra vires.
And that's a question of drafting.
And that's a question of drafting, but it's just not been, we've just not been assisted.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah. And I would, and if I said, if I believed that, or thought the view that you couldn't do that, I would have said that very clearly so that you could take that back to your client, the minister. But I think that we can.
Right.
Now, in trying to understand the law about deemed permits, have not been well positioned to understand that. So then subsequently issued a minute asking what I thought were key questions for me to place myself in a position where we could start to look at, well, what might that planning response be? Now, one of those questions, which is to do with section 124, parties are saying there's no issue. Dr. Somerville is saying is an issue. But there's no issue in principle that there needs to be a planned response. I agree with that. That then, you know, as far as I understand it, if Dr. Somerville is right and you cannot continue to exercise your rights priorities beyond 1 October, then there is a policy lacuna that only gets filled, if you like, by a grant of resource consent, because at that point in time, you then, fingers crossed, hopefully take advantage of a policy which is in this plan change.
Yeah.
So, you know, to that extent, there is a risk for a group of people. And, of course, his opinion, I think, can be seen to be going further than that. That's exactly what I would expect an amicus, I would have expected of a lawyer to do. If a question is asked of an amicus or any lawyer by their client, and if there are broader considerations at foot, I would expect that lawyer to be telling their client that. Now, it seems to me, reading Dr. Somerville's second opinion, that he is signalling that there are broader considerations. Now, that may be something that I don't need to decide, because that, if he is right, it arises due to the operation of the statute. All the court can do to minimise any risks for persons seeking to replace those deemed permits is to turn out its decision quickly. But I understand that in turning out its decision very quickly, that at least for one of the parties that that wouldn't make any difference, because they wouldn't be in a position to respond before 1 October. So that's, to me, that's just litigation risk. It's nothing that the best court can do is put people in the best position that they are able to be in, and that is what we've offered. And we're still pondering that, whether or not we need to make a decision on it, on whether Dr. Somerville is right about the expiry at 1 October of all rights or not. The court is of a view that there does need to be something in this plan change. Everything else is for the parties.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think that probably is...
I think that's long enough.
Long enough, yeah. So you've had a chance to look over what the court said in its own provisions, its own suggestions.
Yes, yes.
Intravirus, ultravirus.
Very briefly, I tried to get hold of Mr. Ansell last night.
Oh, yeah. He's busy.
He is busy, and he was still busy when I tried to get hold of him, but he has it, and I know that Mr. De Pelsmaker has been communicating with him, yes, I think so, to set up to... the further consideration of it. All I had from him was a sort of looks pretty good type text.
Looks message. Pretty good.
But it was a text message, and it was kind of on the fly. But he obviously is considering it, and I wouldn't want to express a view without some assistance from him.
Yeah, he might have. I mean, regardless, you know, of the planner's options, the court's suggestions, or any other solution, you know, the effectiveness of those solutions is troubling the court, because what troubles the court is both the record keeping, you know, the implementation troubles the court, regardless of what solution is presently before us, the record keeping, the access to the records. And the other thing troubling the court would be that there has been action taken by permit holders
for which authorisation was required, but which authorisation wasn't sought in terms of moving points of take or even, I don't know, conferring the deemed permits to another permit holder.
Yeah.
And you might say, well, whose problem is that? And I'd say that's probably a problem for the permit holder in the first instance and the council in the second.
Yeah.
But it's not, I can't see that it's a problem for the court because, we just do not have sufficient factual basis to think about any solutions. Mm. But the implementation troubles us. And I can't say anything more about that because we,
It seems that we have laid to rest the border issue of the virus. It seems that we have laid to rest between us issue of the virus. It's just making sure that the mechanism itself is intravirus.
It doesn't give rise to any virus issues, and it's so in principle, yes, we think you need something in the plan change, or government will have to come forward because the risks to individuals are potentially significant in terms of their economic impact. So there has to be a mechanism by government or a mechanism in this plan change, and we need to craft that in a way that it is. That it doesn't infringe any, that it is both lawful and is effective. It is,
Your Honour, I'll find you those cases. Mr. Welsh has one, I'll find the other. It seems to me that you don't need the condition in writing that I was referring to.
You could just give me the condition reference. I've actually got Queensbury up on my computer now.
There's a reference at paragraph 69. Paragraph 6, and it's discussed again at 69. There's not a lot of discussion of it, but the condition itself is.
In the condition itself?
Paragraph 6 and 69. And then it will be in.
Oh, I see. It's probably condition 6A, looking at it. Combined volume.
Indeed.
From the Albert and Clutha. Oh, no, it's not.
I'll check the number.
Yeah, if you could just give us the condition.
Sorry, yes, it reference. Is. Six capital A,
okay.
No.
No, that's why I said, oh, no, it's not. That just looks like what you combine volume is.
I'll come back to you.
You'll come back to me, that's very good.
Rather than
trying
to read it on the fly.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Page.
I think you've got. Welsh was going before me.
I don't mind. Yeah, it does no difference to me. I've read your submission, Mr. Welsh.
You have, ma'am?
I have, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Ma'am, I have copies of, and I've checked, I didn't circulate, I didn't file these at the same time as filing those submissions. I have a clean copy of the Ryder decision. And,
oh, thank you.
And I have I think it's the first 12 pages of the Rotokawa decision, but that's the relevant part for the purposes of our discussion. It's quite a large decision.
All right.
And the third case that I refer to in my submissions has already been placed before the court, and that's the Judge Smith's decision that Ms. Williams, I think, provided in respect of the Minister of Conservation and Otago Regional Council. That set out some of that background as to mining privileges and where they come from and how at that stage they were before the courts. So I haven't handed that up, and the other reason I haven't handed up, I've got highlighting on that, so it wouldn't be appropriate to do so. Ma'am, I don't intend to summarise my submissions, but I'll answer obviously any questions you have in respect of those, and just use the balance of my time in respect of responding to Dr. Somerville's latest memorandum, if that's acceptable to the court. I would start by noting that Dr. Somerville's further memorandum has, at least in my mind, removed any doubt that appeared in his May memorandum as to whether he had considered that it was the deemed condition of priority that could not rely upon 124 to survive, or whether the entire deemed permit could not. In my submission, Mum, Dr. Somerville's earlier memorandum was a little bit loose in its language around whether he was referring to the deemed permit or the deemed condition on priority at times. But he has removed all doubt with his second memorandum and indicated it's both. Mm. So at paragraph 5 and 6, Dr. Somerville agrees that section 124.3 applies to deemed permits. However, he then goes on to opine that 124 sub 3 is available up to, or only available up to, 1 October. In response, I would note that that is not what the RMA says on the face of it, at least in my reading. A pragmatic examination of the resource consent application process and section 124 demonstrates that there is no need for a deemed permit holder to rely on section 124.3 prior to 1 October, as their permit has not expired. In essence, under Dr. Somerville's interpretation, in my submission, section 124 would be rendered meaningless. This is because prior to 1 October, the only relevance of section 124 would be in providing, and in probably Plan Change 7 parlance, entry conditions for reliance after 1 October, those entry conditions being the filing of a replacement application 6 months prior to the deemed permit expiring, or between 6 and 3 months if the consent authority allows the consent holder to continue to operate. And today being the 1st of July, no party, if they have not filed already, can take the benefit of section 124 in the context of continuing to rely on their deemed permit. At paragraph 11, Dr. Somerville submits that a deemed water permit is not like any other resource consent with an expiry date, as it is a creature of statute. To an extent, I agree, deemed permits are creatures of statute, just like existing rights under section 386(1)(a), existing authorities under 386(1)(b), existing permissions that became deemed coastal permits under 384, and clean air permit or permissions that became deemed discharge permits under section 385. And indeed, resource consents under the RMA, which do not exist at common law or equity. Deemed permits are under section 413(1), deemed to be water or discharge permits granted by the appropriate consent authority on the same conditions. Section 87 says that a water permit and a discharge permit are resource consents. I agree that they finally expire on 1 October 2021, and I don't think any party has submitted otherwise. But that isn't the point. The issue is that these are resource consents, and that notwithstanding a deemed condition that the deemed permit expires, section 124 allows the holder to continue to operate under the existing consent until all appeals are determined. And that's no different, in my submission, from any other resource consent. In response to Dr. Somerville at his paragraph 12, I disagree with the suggestion that there was no need for Parliament to explicitly state that deemed permit holders could not rely on section 124 if that was its intention. I address that in my submissions at paragraphs 10 and 13.
Sorry, just say that again.
I disagree with the suggestion that there was no... There's a few double negatives in there, Mark, but I disagree with the suggestion that there was no need for Parliament to explicitly state that deemed permit holders could not rely on section 124 if that was its intention. Dr. Somerville took issue with myself and some other parties when we noted that if Parliament had intended 124 not apply, it could have simply said so like it had with section 165ZH. And Dr. Somerville, in reply, has said there was no need for Parliament to do that. And I disagree with that. I note that Parliament, in fact, actually did state that section permits under section 165ZH cannot rely on section 124. So it turned its Parliament, in my submission, turned its mind to the application of section 124. But more importantly, and I think Dr. Somerville, with respect, has missed this, Parliament has explicitly provided in 143 sub 1 and sub 7 that the provisions of the RMA generally and part 6 specifically apply apart from the review provisions. And self-evidently, part 6 includes section 124. At 13, Dr. Somerville opines that section 1243 is not available after 1 October, and as there is no longer an existing consent at that point in time. That is correct after 1 October that the consent has finally expired, the deemed permit. But he has, in my respectful submission, misinterpreted section 124 and its references to existing consent. In my submission, in the context of section 124, the reference to the existing consent is in respect of the entry conditions for relying on the application of section 124. That is, filing an application 6 months prior to its expiry, or between 6 and 3 months prior to its expiry with the consent authority's approval. At those relevant times, there is, of course, an existing consent. At 14 and through to 16, Dr. Somerville deals with the case law that I referred to in my submissions. And I agree with Dr. Somerville that those cases do not deal with deemed permits or rights of priority under deemed permits. My submissions did not suggest otherwise. The reason for addressing those cases is that they dealt with existing authorisations under section 386, which were deemed to be granted under the RMA on the same conditions by the appropriate consent authority, and which finally expire, in that case, on the 10th anniversary of the commencement of the Act. And it seemed to me, Mum, that Dr. Somerville had placed in his first memo considerable weight and importance on the language of finally expired, but had not addressed the court on the similar or the exact same language that appears elsewhere in the Act, namely 386. So that's why I provided those cases in my submissions. They're not on deemed permits under 413. They are on existing authorisations under 386. And, Mum, picking up on a discussion you had with Ms. Dixon in terms of other applications that have relied on Section 386, I did look at the Waipori decision issued by His Honour Judge Smith. I think the reference off the top of my head is C001-2004, which dealt with the Waipori scheme. It's referenced Save Mahinerangi, Inc. Senior counsel in that case was Dr. Somerville, and that decision dealt with the reconsenting of the Waipori scheme, which had existing authorisations. And to the best of my recollection, Ma'am, there was no suggestion by senior counsel on either side, where it was Dr. Somerville and Mr. Withnell QC, that Trustpower could no longer rely on those consents post 1 October 2001. I did thought it would be quite cute to provide reference from His Honour Judge Smith in respect to that, but looking at the decision, it doesn't deal with it at all. It just proceeds on the basis of hearing the appeal. But coming back to the reason for referencing those two decisions, Ryder and Rotokawa, I thought it was important to point out in 386 that essentially the same language of 413 exists and is therefore at least analogous or very informative to your decision making. I just have been thinking about your questions around 386.8, Mum, as to why would there be that carve out, and it would seem to me that the reason for that carve out may be that unlike the existing authorisations and existing rights, which also deal with water, they were quite, or those rights and authorisations came from quite a different, well, they are different beasts from mining privileges. They were issued by the regional water boards as opposed to the wardens, mining wardens, and they were issued under the Water and Soil Conservation Act 1967 as opposed to mining privileges that had their genesis under the Mining Act provisions or Act. But both deal with takes of water. And in my submission, Ma'am, nothing really turns on the carve-out of 386.8. It simply is trying to avoid any, in my submission, any confusion that 386 is intended to apply to mining privileges, which has its own discrete section, notwithstanding much the same language appears in both. As Dr. Somerville had not addressed 386 in his earlier memorandum, despite what appeared to me to be an emphasis on the words finally expire at his 42 and 45 of his May memo, and has not explained why, despite the same language used, why section 386 and 413 would, in his opinion, result in diametrically opposed outcomes when both sets of rights are both deemed water permits under the RMA. 386 is also a deeming provision. In respect of paragraphs 19 to 32, I'll leave that for Mr. Page because Dr. Somerville is essentially devoting a fair chunk of his response to Mr. Page's submissions. But I do note in response to paragraph 29, Dr. Somerville's interpretation in my submission leads to the antithesis of the interpretive presumption set out in section 29. And I dealt with some of that some of those outcomes in paragraph 4 of my submission, which are well beyond Dr. Somerville's considerations. But in my submission, the abrupt cessation of all deemed permits that have not been replaced by 1 October may result in significant and irreversible effects. Now, have in mind there a return of all flows to a stream where previously trout and brook char have not been able to gain access upstream due to the abstraction, and a population of galaxids existed prior to 1 October. And, Mum, I would just observe, in my opinion, it's highly unlikely that these deemed permits will be finally determined prior to 1 October, notwithstanding the dedication and hate or speed that you devote to writing your decision, the court's decision. I cannot see how applicants can amend their applications if need be, council perform its processing functions, no doubt hold hearings, and trigger, at least in terms of any discretionary or non-compliant visa, hearing could be required, and of course appeals to the court.
Thank you. So regardless of how quickly the court can turn out its decision and thereby seek to mitigate any risk arising, should Dr. Somerville is proven to be right, I think your advice is that the court can't do much within that space, just simply because of the volume of applications together with the processing time.
Correct, ma'am.
Oh, well, we offered.
Well, I would be happy to be proved wrong, but I just can't see if that is if the court has in mind that as a potential solution to the issue,
it's not a solution to the issue. It's just trying to, if Dr. Somerville is right, if the court doesn't need to make a decision on whether or not, if the court needs to make a decision that yes, there should be provision in the plan change, and I think we're there and have been for some time, but doesn't need to make a decision on whether or not deemed permits finally expiring on the 1st of October and Section 124 doesn't apply either to the deemed permit nor to the right of priority, then anything else that ensues is beyond the court's reach. What the court must do, and the court, I think, is your submission, and I think in principle we are there, is that the court needs to make some sort of provision to regulate abstraction as between abstractive.
Yeah, so my submission, ma'am, was not in respect of the priority issue per se.
No. I understand your anxiety.
I've tried to stick to the lane
to
of
the broader
issue.
Yes. Yeah. No, I understand what your anxiety is there.
Yes.
Yep. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honour. In terms of the drafting, I think there's probably a wee way still to go in terms of the priority drafting. At the risk of trying to draft by committee, for example, ma'am, I thought that one of the planners will need to come back and actually encapsulate in the court's drafting what or how much or at least what is sufficient to supply the downstream permit holder. What's that measured against? Is it their maximum right? Is it... I don't know.
I bet you... what is sufficient? It seems on what little we know, it's whatever the superior permit holder says is sufficient. It's not a science. It's never been approached as a science, where people have been. Apart from the total secession, it's not approached as a science.
But, ma'am, where that's tracking is that where I was going to get to is where the court's thinking is. I see no issue with you setting up an ultra vires condition.
An ultra vires?
No issue with you setting up an ultra vires condition.
You mean intra vires? Hopefully it's within the law?
It would be within the law. I see no issue that you have set up an ultra vires condition. What you're doing and where you're tracking would be intra vires.
Oh, good. I thought you were saying the opposite.
Sorry, I was saying it in the negative. But No. No, it would be intravirus.
Yeah, we are trying to track an intravirus, the setup for an intravirus condition, that there are implementation issues there might be, but I just at this stage can't see the way around that. There wouldn't be a way around that as far as I can see, even by Parliament. It would probably encounter the same implementation issue. So.
No, it's not to say ultra-virus conditions don't result by any consent authority, notwithstanding the best of plan drafting, but, Mum, I have no anxiety at all in respect of where that condition is tracking in terms of any intra- or ultra-virus issues. It seems entirely appropriate.
Okay. Oh, well, that's good to hear.
Yes. Thank you. There are my submissions, Mum.
Mr. Page. Mr. Page. No, I was only looking at morning tea. Am I quite able to take morning tea or just continue on? It's over to you.
Well, the
the morning tea suggestion might be useful, because what we've been doing over here while all this has been going on is doing some drafting using your template, and we've emailed some revisions to that drafting to Dahlia, and I would like to speak to that on the screen when I address the VIRAs issue. And it may, and I don't know whether Jared's in a position to do that. Oh, he is. Fabulous.
So we just need to expand it so we can see it. Yeah. Oh, that's perfect.
Oh, Ms. Irving and I.
Ah, cool. All righty. Do you want to, what do you want us to do? To take that, just get a copy of that and have morning tea and then come back? So this is your drafting now?
Yes, yeah. this is our drafting now, and I wanted to speak to it.
Okay.
And it may be worthwhile, you have, I mean, I don't have the capacity to produce copies other than...
We do. Yep.
Yes.
Okay, so we'll take morning tea and have a look at it.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'd have to say that, and of course this would have been obvious when we said, let's have a conference of council with Dr. Somerville, that sometimes planners need direction on intra and ultra virus provisions and all the rest of it. So, you know, the fact that you are drafting doesn't bother me in the least.
No. Well, yeah. And I would like to think that planners don't have a monopoly on drafting skills either.
Yes.
Well, absolutely.
Yes.
On that bombshell.
Engineers, particularly. Yeah. All right, very good. So we'll take a copy of that and have a break and then come back. All right. All rise.